conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Bressel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. Dialogue Conspiracy, July 22nd, 1974. Nice summer day in Carmel, California. We'll cover a wide variety of subjects, as usual, as much as I can get into these 45 minutes. I'm receiving a lot of mail from Boston and Sacramento, a tremendous amount of mail every week. I'm answering it all. I answered about 60 letters this week. And I'll answer your questions, and some I'll answer on the air if I think they're broad enough for inclusive enough for everyone to share. A lot of them ask about the background of the work that I'm doing, and one of the best ways to find out this month on the newsstand, Playgirl magazine has an interview with me, and it gives a background of how I happened to get into my research and what I was doing at the time that John Kennedy was assassinated. So if you pick up the August 74 Playgirl, it'll give you a good background on how I got into the work, and it'll save me answering all of these letters personally. It'll be on the stand for another couple of weeks, and it's been out about 2 weeks. And I also get requests for the things I've written up to the present time. You can send me $2, and that covers the postage and the three articles that I did in the past 2 years. And I'll give you information on the new one. The SLA article is at the printers now and should be out in about 3 weeks. The Thunderbird still carries in Carmel, California, the local bookstore carries those articles, and they seem to be in demand now with a lot of Watergate evidence breaking that I had printed 2 years ago. It's good to go back and compare what was happening 2 years ago at the time of the Watergate arrest with what the White House tapes say, and then compare it to my research, and you can come to some conclusions then about the validity or the course of that I was going to in my research. It's a good guideline if you own these articles, the one I did last year and the year before, because then the things that I say sometimes that sound very outlandish now, 2 years from now, you may accept as having happened that way or look into them a little closer if you can see how I came to my conclusions with the Watergate affair. On the news today was the subject of Philip Agee, the gentleman from the CIA, worked with them 12 years, who's writing a diary. At first, the CIA tried to smear him and said he gave information to the KGB, which he didn't do. He's abroad now writing a book, and it comes purely from the same motivations that I'm doing my research or trying to expose the CIA, and he's inside of it. It's purely an unselfish motive that he saw that American imperialism was ruining many countries, which he said that we're trying to get a democratic reform program going. And he first saw it in Ecuador when he lived there. And he realized that the masses are kept far away from the ruling class, and that we do in Latin America what we've done in many countries and what we did in Vietnam. We strengthen what is a minority government, which perpetuates the wealth of a few, he said, and allows widespread poverty for many. And the important thing as we go into the next year, while I'm doing my broadcast, and soon you'll have the SLA article that I did, the article discusses how we are using that program, escalating it at home in the United States. We can't talk about Ecuador or Mexico. He will tell you what they do in those countries, the CIA, but this is what they are doing domestically. That Tom Charles Houston plan is working. And we cannot look away to other countries and talk about the CIA. Listen to what he's saying when his diary comes out and read all the news articles about him, what he's done for the CIA and how they work, and see if it isn't happening here. In his comments in the press this week, he said, in quotes, that he was involved in the local assassination of employed CIA agents inside the United States. And he said at least one such killing involved the use of a truck to run over a recently utilized local CIA operative whose mission had been accomplished. Now, that's the kind of thing I talk about in Dialogue Conspiracy, That's what I told Colston Westbrook, who was a CIA agent that worked with Donald DeFries, and he said the SLA was going to kill him, and I called him up on a radio talk show, and I said, why wouldn't the CIA kill you if you worked for them? Why won't they kill you now? Because that's their usual habit. They did this with people related to the Kennedy assassination, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. The periphery of persons that worked with them or had information are killed off. So why wouldn't the CIA agents involved in the SLA also be killed? Why can't he be killed by his same team? I thought of Robert Crown, a very liberal assemblyman in California who is the staunch advocate against the death penalty, and the law enforcement here were pushing the death penalty last year, and Robert Crown was jogging in San Francisco, and I only had to do the very small amount of research to come to an opinion that he was run over by this car and was killed purposely. And when his deciding vote was erased, then the death penalty went through. There was a lot of manipulation. And the police authorities called me from the Oakland area when they heard that I was saying this, and I talked to them at length about it and was more convinced after I talked to them than ever that he was run over. The important thing is that many people are lethargic, they're confused, they don't know how to turn when they hear these facts. And the important thing is that when men like Philip Agee, he's putting his life on the line, he's afraid of his life, but he is going to tell the truth, and there are teams of people like Victor Marchetti telling the truth now, and as the conscience becomes more defined and clear and people are tired of murder and genocide and killing and they've had enough, they'll come forward. And the best thing we can do is to back up what these people are saying with our years of research, those of us who have done it, and then tell you to read these articles in the paper. The one there he talked about political assassinations was written by Seymour Hersh in the New York Times last week. And he talked about using a truck to run over an agent after he'd done their assignment. Last week we talked about Earl Warren and the suggestion of Hanky Pank down in Bakersfield. At the time his father died, and it was the year that Earl Warren was becoming the Attorney General in California. And I received a telephone call this week from a gentleman. I won't share his name. He had seen the article about me in Playgirl and about the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission being a fraud. And he called me on the telephone this week and just by coincidence is very familiar with the whole law enforcement trip in Kern County. He mentioned that he knew about the Warren family and the death in Kern County in the years of 1935 to 39, and when he said that, my ears perked up because I associated immediately with the death of Earl Warren's father, the murder. And this man brought in information which backs up exactly what I was saying, only involves the agents, law enforcement agents, who had firsthand knowledge of some of this. And I asked him if a person very familiar with the case, now that Earl Warren is dead, would be a guest on my radio show. And he's going to look into that, and it will come very spontaneously someday. It won't be announced in advance, but if I can get a man who is directly related to that murder and the cover-up who can tell you exactly how it came down, and I won't have to make any innuendos or suggestions, but how this man rose to the height of political power to be the Chief Justice of the United States, I will have this guest on. A lot of people wonder maybe what is my motive for digging out all these bodies and seeking these people. I don't get any satisfaction in it. I was interested in the history of who killed John Kennedy and raising a family. I wanted to know what was happening in the world that they were growing up in. And believe me, never in my wildest dreams did I believe that you had so many people murdering other people in order to gain power. And that's what Mr. Agee was saying in his book. It's the ballot is done by bullets, and he's going to reveal the way that power moves also in his book. But I never dreamt when I started doing work into who killed John Kennedy how massive, I guess I was naive and really stupid, how much murder is used for the men who act at the top to be very distinguished and very reputable members of our society to be directly involved with political assassinations and murders, or murders directly close in their community in order for them to gain that power, whether they're district attorneys or justices or whatever. It is a common way of moving, and in my innocence, I got into this thing, and I've stayed with it ever since. I have spoken every week about the prison situation. I've mentioned a prisoner out in Soledad, Robert Hyde, who has been hounded continuously. I've mentioned on the news service a Michael Ankenbrandt, who was approached to murder Robert Hyde. I've mentioned another man last week whose life was in danger, Larry Wilson, who was approached to murder Robert Hyde. And this week, a third person came. And I've read letters that I've written to Vacaville and Folsom. They've moved him around, and I'm determined that he should live and he should be out. His time is up. He shouldn't even be in prison. And I've studied the circumstances of why the prison officials are so anxious to get Robert Hyde. But this last case where they hired a man, or they didn't hire him, they approached him and gave him a weapon. They also, the prison officials whose names I have and I've called out there, also suggested that this man should take a code name of Dang and that he should leave the prison and become part of kidnapping two more of the Hearst girls, that there was a plan set up to kidnap two more of Patricia Hearst's sisters. And I called the FBI in San Francisco. The San Francisco Chronicle called me today. And I think the best way to get to this situation is to do a public exposure. The men out at Soledad deny it, but I know John Mitchell, the Attorney General, would deny that he was going to kidnap people or poison them with acid and send them to another country or blackmail them with all kinds of compromising positions. That's the Attorney General. And the assistant out at Soledad assured me that his career was involved in taking care of prisoners, his reputation was involved, and I assured him that my reputation as a researcher was equally important, and that we're going to get to the bottom of this thing, because three men they're living like animals in an isolated section, four of them. Their lives are threatened. Their families have called me from three different areas, and I know terror when I see it. I know these families' terror. One woman came to me with her mother, and they drove all the way over from the prison to tell me what had happened, and we decided to give it the most amount of attention or publicity in order to stop this massive killing. There was a new stabbing at San Quentin today out here in California, and there's what they call a rash of walkaways from the prison. One man walked away from Folsom Prison, and I think it's important to save those names now, the walkaway, and see if they're involved in any more political kidnappings or assassinations. Well, why is this happening in California, and why is this important to talk to the East Coast and around the country? It's symbolic for one thing. George Jackson was in Soledad, and he called it Dachau or Auschwitz. When you talk about Nazi Germany, you think of a particular set of extermination camps or prisons, and I think we have our share out here in California where they're trying to kill the political prisoner or kill his mind. But also in California, we had the murder of Robert Kennedy, Senator Robert Kennedy. And you know, in Dallas, Oswald, the alleged assassin of John Kennedy, who didn't shoot him, was murdered in the police department. Jack Ruby died in the Dallas jail after a 3-week session of cancer and injections. So out in California, we have a man sitting in San Quentin named Sirhan Sirhan, who did not kill Robert Kennedy. And a lawsuit was placed by a gentleman named Mr. Zatko, Vladimir Zatko, and he filed it September the 11th, 1973, because Mr. Zatko claims that he was placed in San Quentin for the purpose of murdering Sirhan Sirhan. And this is the case that Robert Hyde had knowledge of, and this is why they want to kill the people who have knowledge of what is taking place inside the prison. The Watergate has gone just a little bit. They've covered a small amount of territory, as much as the nation can take for a little while, but they still haven't gone into the Wallace shooting, Mary Kopechne's death, we're going to talk a little bit about that today again, and the Robert Kennedy murder, because that's how these people came to power in the first place. There was a news release this week that William Sullivan, in one of the White House tapes, took information that J. Edgar Hoover had on his desk, and that he controlled the presidents, that he blackmailed them for things that they had done in the past. And William Sullivan of Division 5 of the FBI is knowledgeable of all the past political assassinations. He's in a hospital now, resting up from what they have these heart attacks where they send people off when the heat gets too hot. But Sullivan and these people are, for all purposes, in power because they're not exposed. And as long as they're not exposed, these continuous cycles of murders of prisoners and people inside our prison and our alleged assassins is going to go on. And Mr. Zatko placed a lawsuit against Richard Nixon, and I have a copy of it here. It was placed, as I say, September the 11th, 73. And I've read it on the air before, but I want to repeat part of it, because he says that he has $25,000, as I said, I've received an advance payment of $25,000, U.S. dollars, which is still untouched and deposited in a California bank, and that it was given to him by the members of the White House plumbers, he says, and it's a lawsuit against Richard Nixon. This suit was sent to Honorable Judge Thomas McBride. It's a legal paper written up to Judge McBride. I have another document of Vladimir Zatko, which is signed September the 20th, 1973, where he says, while in San Quentin, I've been interviewed by the FBI, the Secret Service. I am tortured with lighted cigarettes on my forearms, and the spots are visible. I'm beaten, sadistically humiliated by the same persons. They applied a hypodermic needle and various substances that caused me partially or totally to lose control of my mind, free will, and senses. And such atrocities committed on my person result in paralysis in my left leg, ruined my health entirely for the rest of my life. Now, this is signed, it was notarized and sent in September 73. I reiterate that because these people know that Zatko is in San Quentin and he doesn't want to kill Robert Kennedy, and he tells the FBI, that's when his tortures come down. When I tell the FBI that Soledad is leaving people to let them escape, the people who talk get tortured and they get threatened for their life, that they'll be murdered and they'll be hung or they're locked up forever. And the FBI, I'm illustrating this over and over again because Mr. Kelly is saying that he can't find Patty Hearst and everybody should help them and it's a disgrace. The public aren't at large out there helping them find. And I'm accusing them right now of not getting into all of these things and being behind the torture. I have a letter here, October the 14th, from Mr. Zatko to a researcher in Los Angeles. He says, I'm again in possession of a 1.5-inch needle containing highly poisonous substance, and it was given to him at the Adjustment Center, and he does not want to kill Sirhan. And Zatko is writing a book called From the Vatican to San Quentin. The Vatican I've mentioned on other shows, and I think it's important to see the connection of the Pope is being accused of receiving CIA money. He was in the OSS. And Zatko is writing a book, and I have a copy of the foreword from the book, and he criticizes the American prison system. He says the safety of every individual and every home is at a stake if we don't get into the conditions and lawlessness and immorality that is passing in the American prison system. He says his name is not Zatko, it's Eugene Rangel, and he was given the name of Vladimir Alexander Zatko, who died in an automobile accident in Italy in 1968. He was given it by evidently the CIA and the White House plumbers. In his book, he says, the prison system in America, never forget, is a state within a state. It has its own system of courts and schools and press. It serves as a transmission belt where the prison mentality is being imposed directly and indirectly on millions of Americans, and they don't understand or fully realize the intellectual manipulation developed by the oligarchy and imposed upon mankind. Even after reading this book, no man can penetrate the diabolical secrecy and the tremendous effectiveness of the intellectuals with which they have imposed slavery upon men and rule them by their schemes without any man ever realizing this during the course of history. He said, I have deep faith in the American people, and he's writing a book to tell them about the present system. And I believe sincerely that the American prison system, which is called Dachau by George Jackson and Auschwitz, is the answer to a lot of the things that are happening in our country today will be resolved when you find out how certain persons are being manipulated inside the prison and being silenced, and everybody who knows about Zatko's being paid to murder Sirhan is being set up for a kill down the line. And if I have to spend every day or every hour of my week calling the prison officials or calling the news media, writing letters, I will do it, because I believe this situation has to end, and people have to stop living in terror. A man goes into prison on a 3-year robbery charge like this. This mother that came to me this week, her son is there on a 3-year charge, 3 years to life, and he wants to get out, and the officials give him a knife and tell him to murder somebody. And he doesn't want to murder. He's taught to murder and told to murder, and he doesn't want to do it. And I will continue to expose it. And I asked them, they denied this was going on. I said, can I go out and see these three men and just see what's going on? They said, absolutely not. And I know what's going on, and I know they won't let me in. The New York, we're going on to another subject, and then to Mary Jo Kopechne. The New York Times had an article July the 6th, 1974. An employee of the CIA had to quit 2 years ago at the time of the Watergate arrest. This is another one named Arthur Hochberg, who is in Singapore. And he worked for Mullen Associates, who also have offices in Central America and in Sweden and Holland. And it's been a cover of the CIA for many, many years. That's the office that E. Howard Hunt had a desk at. And I looked at my Realist article from 2 years ago, and I have there about Robert Bennett and the Mullen Associates, the public relations firm, being a CIA front. And there's quite a few references in that article 2 years ago about how can the Republican Party separate CIA money if the dummy fronts for the Nixon-Agnew re-election come through that office. How do you separate CIA funds from Republican money when you have unlimited money for every purpose to carry off an election? And one of the references in the Realist article I did was about Howard Hunt and his 1972 plans. And briefly, I wanted to mention today, because the William Sullivan name came out again in the news, the White House tapes, the news is full of them, and I get the Washington Post, the New York Times, there's just pages and pages of the impeachment evidence, the White House tapes. But there's one dated March the 22nd, 1973, and Richard Nixon says, I want you all to stonewall it. Let them plead the Fifth Amendment. Let them plead anything. He says, a cover-up or anything else if it'll save the plan. Now, the election is over. What is the plan? The elections are over. It's March 22nd, 1973. The plan, I've said many times, was that martial law plan. It's what Charles Colson calls a 7 days inmate plan. It's what I had written up, the plan. But you see it clearly in these tapes, to stonewall it, plead the Fifth, anything to save the plan. And the plan is still saved because nobody touches E. Howard Hunt or James McCord. They're the top boys of the CIA. They were very important at the Watergate Hotel, and they're still out. They're not in jail, and the plan is still operating. A little bit about the plan. I don't know what to make of this. I got a letter from a researcher in Ohio. He says, I'll read the quote. A camp is opening up right here at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, old World War II barracks, for POWs, and it's being rebuilt, and the utilities are installed. And a black kid doing summer work on it was told by an officer, you better hurry up and finish this. We'll have your black ass in here soon. It's run by the Army out of DESC, Defense Electronic Supply Company, and the rebuilding is called Operation PEIC. Now, the person who sent me this letter has just finished an article on refurbishing of concentration camps in America, which fits in with the position I take in the new SLA article I just finished. And he thought PEIC could be public emergency internment camps. So I'm going to read this over, and all of you who listen who want to take a part, I think of all the letters I get of the 60 I answered this week, maybe 50 said, what can we do? Well, you people can sit down and write letters. You can write to Senator Cranston or Taney or whoever you believe in back in Washington. They're on summer vacation, so keep a duplicate. And if you don't get an answer, write later. If you know people in Ohio, have them check it up. I called Dick Gregory. He was in Oberon, Ohio at the last weekend. It's Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, old World War II barracks. That's outside of Dayton, because this person that wrote to me is from Dayton, Ohio. And find out what the DESC, what is the Defense Electronics Supply Company by the Army, the Defense Electronics Supply Company, refurbishing barracks that they're threatening that they're going to round up black people and put in there. This wasn't a black radical they were talking to, and I don't take it as a figure of speech, because I'm watching certain news come down, and I think you should find out. And then we should write to Washington and find out what Operation PEIC is. That's all I know. Find out if it is the public emergency internment. Find out how big this place is, who's refurbishing it, and if you hear of any more of these things in your states, because this show goes to different states, write to me and let me know. The same way I told prisoners, if you get any offer by a guard or somebody inside the prison system to give you a weapon to kill another prisoner, or if you get a chance to escape, to join a revolutionary group, write to me. Don't take the offer. You'll be killed like Donald DeFries anyway. Just write and give me the name of the person making the offer, just like you can go out and search if there are any more camps being refurbished. Let's get them together and collect some of this data. I also got word from a listener who has a shortwave radio, who listens regularly, has for many years, and she listened to a show down in Colombia for 2 nights. It was one on hunger and poverty in the United States. And they were saying on the air that millions of deaths could be avoided that are being caused by the United States. And that had a program down there that was supposed to be a measles program under the guise of U.S. organization Friends of America. They were giving children measles shots, immunizing against measles, and it turns out that they were being sterilized, and they're testing sterilization because they fear normal birth rate. And there's 1 million people unemployed in Colombia. And the radio program went on to say that the ruling class isn't interested in these people and that the real solution is to eliminate them and that they were sterilizing them under the pretext of helping them out in these rural areas, that they're giving massive sterilization by U.S. organizations. And this is something to check out. If the measles immunization is something like the sterilization. And remember the sadistic syphilis experiments that were going on in the South, and nobody spoke up for a long time till it was way out of hand and very tragic. So maybe we can find out some more about what's happening there. Well, it's the 5th anniversary of Chappaquiddick. Ted Kennedy had an outing at a house, at a cottage, and a car went over the ferry. Mary Jo Kopechne was murdered, and that eliminated Senator Ted Kennedy from running for president in 1972. There's a good book on that by Robert Cutler called You, the Jury, regarding Chappaquiddick. I forgot to bring his address to the studio. I'll bring it next week. He lives in Massachusetts, and he's written a book on the impossibility of Ted Kennedy driving the car. But the importance of this article in the New York Times, it's in the magazine section, July the 14th, 1974, and I think it's important for 2 reasons. First, because the New York Times has covered up every possible conspiracy systematically and has been on the side of allowing truth to be disguised as something else. They hide the truth, bury the truth, and assassinate it and pass off some other cover story that suits the assassins as they want it to happen. But this article is a little different, just in the very first sense it begins. I'm almost afraid to read their articles, but I did go into it because I do have to cover the subject extensively whenever something comes out. And the author is Robert Sherrill, who's a good writer. He's exposed a lot of things in Washington. I respect what he says. So I girded myself, and I picked up the article, and it begins with 2 sentences, and I think they're terribly important. It said, 5 years ago, around midnight, July 18, 1969, a black four-door Oldsmobile 88 owned by Senator Kennedy was driven off a bridge on Chappaquiddick Island, Massachusetts, and landed upside down in 8 feet of water. Now, that is a very good sentence. It said a automobile owned by Senator Edward Kennedy went off the bridge into 8 feet of water, because the testimony of 2 gentlemen and Mr. Kennedy was they dived repeatedly under the water, kept going up and down. This is 8 feet of water the car was in. But it's the first article in what I call the establishment press where they're not saying that Senator Kennedy drove the car. And I think one of the big upsetting factors that we'll look forward to in the next elections, if there are elections and not martial law, would be that Ted Kennedy would tell the truth about Chappaquiddick, what really happened, because he was not driving that car, and he's still covering up for somebody for some purpose. And then George Wallace is becoming more verbal about Arthur Bremer being part of a conspiracy that was related directly to the CIA. Well, this article goes into a lot of incidences at Chappaquiddick, the confessions of different people that didn't hold true, the memory losses, the autopsy that never took place, the drinks. It's very important. He said there was rum at the cottage, and only two people drank from a certain bottle of rum. One was Mr. Crimmins, and one was Mr. Kennedy. I've studied the case and the inquest, and the Crimmins story is very important because no one else drank from that bottle. The contents was thrown away, and I believe that Mr. Kennedy was not conscious. He was hit on the head, and the concussion he had made him unconscious, and he woke up over at the hotel later at 2 in the morning, and that he didn't even fall in that water. This article doesn't go that far, but it does limit to what he ingested to this, the two men, if only one, maybe one man, drank from it. But he goes into that subject about the rum. He goes into the car that the sheriff saw on the road much later than Ted Kennedy's car was supposed to go over. And there's a lot of good points in the article. It's July 14th, 1974, the New York Times Magazine. It isn't as good and complete as a book of Bob Cutler, but I will bring that address in next week. He goes into the hearing where the witnesses were questioned, and nobody, the judge didn't believe any of them were telling the truth, and it was very inconclusive. Judge James Boyle concluded that Kennedy was not telling the truth on several points, and he said no effort was made. Cheryl says no effort was made to resolve the numerous contradictions in the testimony. The record of the inquest testimony was withheld from public inspection for months. A grand jury that cranked up to reopen the investigation was cranked down only after 3 hours of testimony. Now, what I'm wondering is, was the grand jury stopped from investigating it so that there'd be a mystery about Ted Kennedy? Instead of going into it, it's much better to leave it as a great big mystery, because if we go into it, we may find the White House plumbers and money of Mr. Kalmbach in 69. They were already had $100,000 on Ted Kennedy, and Tony Laskowitz was up at the island that night. Nobody has said when he arrived there or seen his plane ticket or his transportation or have him say under oath when he arrived at Chappaquiddick. If the White House plumbers were there before the accident, that's one of the big clues in the Chappaquiddick story. And one special Secret Service man, I don't know whether it was Laskowitz or some other one, was in front of the cottage when Mary Jo came out at first and went back in the car and was drowsy. So 5 years have passed. Whether Ted Kennedy will use it as a leverage in 76, whether he's using it now, I don't know. But the story is wide open. He didn't drive the car. And I have to give credit for New York Times and Mr. Robert Cheryl for at least saying that 5 years ago, a car was driven off the bridge, and this time they did not say that Ted Kennedy drove the bridge. When you've done this work as hard as I have for so many years and you know the obstacles, you're grateful for any crumb that even bends towards truth. And in this case, that came out. Well, we're going to do a little bit about the SLA in the last 12 minutes we have. I'm very anxious for my realist article to come out. You know I've worked hard on it. I was telling this gentleman up at the San Francisco Chronicle about it today. I was chewing them out. The Establishment Press, the Associated Press, the United Press, and papers like the San Francisco Chronicle, I explained to him, are in the Middle Ages. They're just not with it. They're not telling the truth. And he said, well, maybe he'd come to the house and cover a story about what I'm doing. And in that article, I have a list of 15 motives for creating the SLA, and every day they're coming through in the news media. And I'm anxious for people to get the article. And then serious researchers, I have a lot of young people that have filing systems, make 15 envelopes of what I call the motives, and as the news breaks, put them into the motives. And one of the subjects I had was to create the scare of kidnappings around the world, international and national, to have a bunch of mini kidnappings, phony kidnappings, or real ones done by CIA agents and provocateurs as an excuse for terror and fear to get more police, more men at airports, more private security guards. So in the San Francisco Chronicle today, there was an article about kidnapping in Argentina. It's the Associated Press article, and it tells about the use of bank robbery and kidnapping as a political tool. But then it goes on, and this is really funny. This is by Luis Agrello, a former federal police inspector in Argentina. He claimed that there's a phenomenon of self-kidnappings, that a large number of the abductions of foreign internationalists in many countries are self-induced. This is like your prison walkaways, what I call they're letting these men out to do crimes, you know, opening the door and calling them walkaways. And I refer to phony kidnappings in my article, that there's a rash of them and that they're taking place for a reason. But there's a new name. He calls these self-induced kidnappings, where the kidnappings are planned by the victims themselves or their companies to divert the abduction money from the business illegally. Now, I think it's more than that. They're getting their money back later, and they don't divert this money illegally. What they're doing is setting up a whole rash of kidnappings, like we had hijackings to get guards at every airport. They're setting up these kidnappings. The American businessman stands from this thing because the multinational corporations can have better control. The more police there are to protect their home and their property and their children, and their conscience tells them that people are getting smart and are going to go after them. So they set up these series of mini phony kidnappings, and I list a few in the article, and I have a lot more that I'll put in a book this summer. So when I read about what he calls these phony kidnappings, self-induced, that's like Mr. Dantzler down in Miami, Florida, who goes out to a boat, swims back to his car, and the car is just a few miles away, and he told people he was kidnapped and jumped off a boat, and money was transacted. He didn't do it for any corporation or bank where $30,000 or $40,000 is handed over. It's to put on the books that America had one more kidnapping. So if we carefully go into every one of these kidnappings, we could break the rash of kidnappings within a short period of time. Well, the police report is out on the SLA. Article went to the publisher just a week ago this Monday. It's being typeset, I think, today or proofread. But before the police report was out, I said that Camilla Hall and Nancy Ling Perry were shot at close range by the police department because no member of the SLA was meant to live. They didn't want them to tell the story of how this motley crowd ever got together. So this last week, the police report came out in L.A., and they said that Camilla Hall and Nancy Ling Perry were coming out of the house. You see, Thomas Noguchi, the coroner, said it was the most amazing thing that these people in the light of fire were so dedicated to their cause that he was going to do this great psychological autopsy on their minds. And in the article that I wrote called The Death Trap, I bring out the alternatives. There are only four alternatives to the death trap, and which one was it? And if these existed, if three existed, then the choice of burning themselves, the immolation, wasn't even a factor. So Mr. Noguchi can forget that altogether. And I mentioned that Nancy Ling Perry was shot in the back, in the spine, at close range, and Camilla Hall was shot through the eyes at very close range. And now the article comes out that they were trying to leave the house and that they were shot. The justification for murdering them was that they were shooting at the police. But that justification, they can say that if they want. The truth is that none of these people were meant to live, and they were shot at close range, and I knew that just from reading the very first accounts. Whatever excuse they give, these people wanted to come out, and if they had come out, we would have known how the SLA was formed. But that is something we're not supposed to know any more than we're supposed to know why Jack Ruby was hired to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. The FBI Charles Bates comes out with a sad story. The mystery of Patty is blamed on the public. He said he thinks it's terrible that the police and the FBI have to do all the work, that people, he said, are unobservant or uncaring public. I'm quoting, and he said he's frustrated and losing sleep that an unobservant, uncaring public isn't turning in these people, that they may know where they were. He says, we've interviewed 22,000 people in this damn office alone. He said 150 agents working around the clock. Yet when I call Mr. Charles Bates in San Francisco on Friday afternoon, he's not working there. I said, who's second under him? They give a name. He's not working there. I called Sunday, and I gave a message about planning to open up Soledad so that some more kidnappings could take place. You can't reach them. I asked for the name of the man in charge. He doesn't give his name. That's so that they won't have to say they received the message. It's hard to get Charles Bates, but I'm going to keep trying every day and try to tell them that the information is already out about how Donald DeFries got out of Soledad the first time. Isn't it interesting? I can call the local FBI and tell them this. I can call the prison and tell them this. I call the FBI. But the reason they don't get in touch with me is because they don't want me to tell them what they're doing, because they have plans for the future, and they can't escalate their plans if I tell them in advance that everybody who's been hired or talked into participating doesn't want any part of it. There was an article in the paper, an SLA witness talks. Two people were held in contempt of court. One was Paul Halverson, 29, who was called by the grand jury in San Francisco to talk about Camilla Hall, and he refused to give out information, and then finally he decided that he would. He and his wife would turn over a few things that the FBI wants. His wife is in jail, but he condescended. So what did the FBI want from him? They wanted a postcard that Camilla Hall sent to him from Europe, that she was in Europe last summer. And it just said that she was having a good time and she was in Spain 2 years ago. Well, in the article that I have coming out, I talk about the very oppressed provocateurs in San Francisco. Willie Wolfe spent 9 months in Europe before he went to Berkeley. Colson Westbrook had traveled to many countries around the world before he came to Berkeley and into Vacaville prison. I talk about William Harris going to Poland and Spain and Russia. And E. Howard Hunt's wife worked for the Spanish embassy, and Hunt was in Spain many times. And I think that the book that came out, The Black Abductor, is the style of E. Howard Hunt. And I'm wondering if the FBI isn't collecting all this information to hide where these people were in Spain or Europe, because these people travel quite a bit, and we're being told that they're very oppressed. And I told this gentleman at the Chronicle today, what about these hippies that are traveling around Europe? Who are they seeing? Where did they get the money to go there? What were they doing there? That all of a sudden they seem to have been all traveling around Europe, and they emerge in Berkeley and get right into the explosive prison system and the United Farm Workers and infiltrate the Venceremos and all the radical organizations. And the FBI called them, and at the grand jury in San Francisco, they took these postcards of Spain. And I think what's important is that Ms. Hall was traveling around. None of that is in the profiles you see of these people, their mobility. That's what I call the migratory birds, the way the espionage agents work. But what Mr. Halverson said, Joyce Halverson made this remark before she went off to jail. She said, I hope the grand jury gained something from what they were after, and I hope they will look into the charge that the CIA was behind the SLA. Now, these are people that are asking the grand jury, U.S. Attorney James L. Browning, Jr., who will not bring evidence of the CIA being behind the SLA, but is going to harass radicals until people in the Bay Area write to their assemblyman in California, write to their congressman, and say, look, the U.S. Attorney General isn't any different than Robert Mardian or Patrick Gay or Guy Godwin or G. Gordon Liddy, who worked for the Justice Department, or John Mitchell. This is a cover-up from A to Z, and it's time that we blow this thing wide open and show where the kidnapping came from, which agents were involved, and stop this kidnapping and violence, and then open up our prisons and find out why they're trying to kill the prisoners who have information of the conspiracy. There was another article in the Sunday magazine section of the newspaper, How Kidnap Fever is Rocking Washington. And this is written by Francis Spotts Leighton. I couldn't look up his biography, but I fairly remember his relationship to the CIA. You might look that up, you researchers out there. Francis Spotts, S-P-A-T-Z, Leighton, L-E-I-G-H-T-O-N. And he tells about kidnapping fever in Washington, D.C., and Vice President Gerald Ford has a special bill was passed in Washington, D.C. to allow a large amount of money to protect Gerald Ford's daughter. And $2 million, they talk about a fund that was rushed through after the $2 million Hearst Food giveaway plan. They decide they'd have a law to protect public officials and their children. And it goes on to say that all the congressmen are worried, and Senator Inouye is worried about his family being kidnapped. You see, anyone who criticized the administration at the time of the Senate hearings, you can get even with them by kidnapping their children and blame the SLA. All the liberals of the left, the anti-Nixon people, interestingly, are guarded. It sounds funny, but the article says a $2.75 million increase in Secret Service to protect embassies. And there's a large amount of money set aside to guard Gerald Ford's daughter, and they're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars for new guards. And one of the 15 motives, I said, of this whole thing is to increase the guards. and make that a new business. And they're doing it. A huge amount of money is going into that. Well, I'll do more next week on a resume of the police report of the SLA, a lying story about seeing Q looking for his family in Los Angeles when he knew they were in Cleveland. They were being harassed there. The cover stories don't hold up with what actually happened. And the more that come out, the better, because it'll show the discrepancies later. Well, that's the news for this week. I gave you some homework. You can look up some things that base in Ohio and save articles on violence or kidnapping, and we'll follow them through in the week to come and see how they relate to one plan, which I hope we can foil and save some of these prisoners' lives and expose some of the corruption coming out all around us. Take care of yourselves, and I'll see you next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for over 10 years has been researching the facts behind the political assassinations in this country so that the truth may be revealed. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.